This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we continue our series of some of our favorite interviews of the year with comic, actor, and writer Jerrod Carmichael. This year he won an Emmy for his HBO comedy special called Rothaniel. What does that mean, right? We soon find out. The special is all about secrets. It starts like this.
I want to talk about secrets.
Secrets.
Ooh. She'll whisper it, right? I carried a lot of secrets my whole life. I feel like I was birthed into them. One of my last held secrets is my name. My name is not Jerrod. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Carmichael delivers on that promise to reveal personal secrets about his real name, his family tree, and his sexual orientation. It's a lot. Toward the end, when he's interacting with the audience, his show starts looking like a hybrid of a comedy show and a therapy session. Carmichael has done two other HBO comedy specials, Love at the Store, directed by Spike Lee, and 8, directed by Bo Burnham. Carmichael was also the creator and star of the sitcom The Carmichael Show that ran on NBC for 3 seasons. That show portrayed a fictional version of Carmichael's family. Many episodes portray them disagreeing with each other on complicated and uncomfortable issues like, is it still okay to enjoy Bill Cosby's comedy? Is it okay to have a gun in the house? How do you eulogize a bad father? Is it okay to take the morning after pill if a condom breaks? In Carmichael's HBO Max special, Home Videos, he returned home to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and filmed conversations with his real family members about sensitive family topics. His special, Rothaniel, directed by Bo Burnham, was taped earlier this year at the Blue Note Jazz Club in New York City. It's streaming on HBO Max. Our interview was recorded in April. Jerrod Carmichael, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show. I love the new special. Congratulations. And you really were great on Saturday Night Live. So congratulations on that, too.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. What changed in your life that you were willing and able to tell secrets now on stage?
I think I got tired. I think I grew tired of being someone I wasn't. I felt like I was like just hiding. They call it being in the closet, I guess, for a reason, because it does feel like you just have walls up. You're just like, I felt like I was like walking around with a mask with my face on it. I think it's the best way to describe it. And I started being more honest with my friends. I started being more honest in my life. I don't know. It just kind of all over the past couple of years, it all started happening. It all started coming out. You know, I came out. Family secret, the things I talk about in the show started coming out. I felt freer. I feel freer. I'm still in the process, but the show just captures a moment just where I've just wanted to feel free.
Before we get to coming out, let's start with your name, which you tried to keep secret. Jerrod is your middle name. Your first name, as you reveal in the special, is the title of the special, which is Rothaniel. Tell us about the origin of the name.
The name comes from my father. He named me after my two grandfathers, his father and my mother's father. Robert and Nathaniel combined the two names at birth and never really used it. But like we immediately started using Jerrod. It's mostly all I remember since I was a kid. No one ever called me Rothaniel. I was embarrassed, very ashamed. It was a secret. And you know, as a child, I already felt different enough. And
right.
Like, I don't think that the name helped. And so it was big. It took up too much space and I didn't want it. I didn't want any parts of it.
So what did you have to do to keep your name a secret?
Well, I hid it as much as I could. Yeah, on legal documents, they have to write your first name. So I always hid those and turned papers upside down and never showed anyone my driver's license. And as soon as I got my bank cards, I I had to quickly get them to take the name off because I would forget and they would have the name and I would go through some process there. A few friends knew, a few close friends. And then every now and then it would slip through to the yearbook and I would have to get it erased or some years I would bribe a friend that please don't put Rothaniel, just put Gerard. And yeah, it was a fight. It was a constant fight, constantly hiding it.
You had to keep a lot of secrets as a kid. And one of them was about your family tree, your grandparents, your father, and all the extramarital affairs they had and all the outside children that they had.
It's a lot. One of my grandfathers had dozens outside of his marriage, and the other had a few himself, and including my father, who had a few children outside of his marriage to my mother, which I knew about, I found out about at an early age. And it's in my family history, you know, in a real way. And I think it's more common than, in the South. I feel like a lot of families where I'm from share that secret or have families like that, or at least know families or in families like that some way.
So these are powerful things to be carrying around as a child. You're hiding your name.
Yeah.
When you figure out your sexual orientation, you're hiding that. You're hiding the truth about your father's relationship. You're hiding it from that you know from your father. You're hiding his relationship from your mother. You're living with them. I mean, you see them every day. And you have this huge secret you're carrying around about their relationship. How did you bear all that?
It's something you figure out later as an adult, you know, reflecting on your childhood or going to therapy or talking to friends. I thought I did. I thought I bared it. I thought I bared it without consequence, I should say. And I didn't go out unscathed. It's definitely things that affect my behavior to this day, fears, you know, my hypochondriacal nature. All things kind of stem from mistrust. But at the time, I don't know, I was scared. I think I lived in fear. It was a lot of consequence or stakes to to everything.
How could you even trust your father knowing how he deceived your mother? Did you wonder, what else don't I know about you? What else are you hiding?
Yes, it definitely causes me to have, fear of a duplicitous nature of all things. Everyone, I question everything still, and I'm sure that has, a huge effect on me. It should be said that my father is very fun. He's charismatic. He was good to be around. He used to wrestle with us in the backyard. And, you know, he would pull up in the driveway. And all of my friends loved him as well. He would pretend to be the Rock and just get out and talk trash. And we would talk trash back and sometimes get out the camcorder and, film each other, you know, with water hoses tied around a clothesline to resemble the ropes and like mats laid out on the grass and just slamming each other around. And my dad would be out there with us. He would play video games with us. He would tell stories. And he was one of the few fathers in the neighborhood. Again, a lot of broken families. And it was a role that he took on kind of silently, you know, being a father to many of my friends who would just be at our house. My mother would read the Bible to us. My father would make us laugh, which made it all the more devastating, I guess, you know, that there was this other side of a person. Yeah, yeah, but I love him. I love him.
Especially with your mother reading the Bible, you know, like your mother's reading the Bible to friends and you're keeping this really big secret about the family. That must have been strange.
Well, you, again, also like later in life, you start realizing really irony and a lot of the Bible verses that my mother would read and how they would reflect situations that she didn't know. Jeremiah chapter 33, verse 1-3. Call unto me and I will answer thee and show thee great and mighty things which thou knowest not. My mother would read that, probably still reads it daily. And I always, I guess I found it funny then. It's ironic now.
What does that passage mean to you?
Well, it's someone searching for answers, the unseen truth. But like, I would hear verses like that Jeremiah verse. She would always do verses about protection, and I always felt like I was guarding her. And one time I went home a few years back, once I moved to L.A., and I was visiting. I went to church with my parents, and the pastor started doing like this somewhat prosperity teaching. It's very popular, obviously, in most churches. We don't have to get into it. But anyway, he was talking about sowing a seed, as they call giving money. And he was saying that just whatever you give, you'll receive tenfold, or I'm not sure whatever the amount is, by the end of the week. And he's saying this on Sunday. And I watched my mother go into her purse and put money into the envelope. And I'm like, you know, obviously me just like kind of mocking it in my head. I can't believe you're doing it. I think I mocked it out loud in church. I whispered, I can't believe you're doing this. Like, you're sowing the seed. Like, we should know better than that. And she gives the money. We go back home. Anyway, I'm staying home. I always stay home for like a few days whenever I go. And whenever I leave, I always give my parents cash. I like plant a certain amount of money in like their sock drawer and hide it and let them find it after I go. And like a decent amount of pocket money. But not to be gross and say amounts, but I'm like putting $2,000 in my mom's sock drawer and having a flash to the $20 she put in church. And I'm like, damn it, they got me. Like, it got me again. Like, look at me. I'm like a pawn in this relationship between God and my mother. And I'm doing it again, you know. But things like that, I always kind of felt like the result of what she was asking God for. I was prayed over. I was prayed for. Deacons and pastors and women of the church would lay hands on my mother and pray. And she wanted a boy, and she just had a miscarriage and had me. Sorry to get into all of that, but I'm just saying how important that relationship with God is, and how much it was instilled in me as a child.
Oh, God, it's so complicated. You know, like you are, like your existence is God's gift to your mother. And that was instilled in you right from the start. And you were so involved in your church. And yet, you know, there was, quote, sin in your home. You know, I put that in quotes.
No. That's a direct quote.
Okay.
That's not a false quote. I think that's how it would be described.
That's so confusing to a child, isn't it?
Yeah. It definitely shaped my perspective. Again, like I remember the fear. I remember the anxiety. I remember just the need to perform, the need to change the energy of a room. If a secret could potentially come out or things could go in a direction that I thought had great consequence, you know, maybe something that revealed my father or me, like, you know, it was too dangerous. So I, you know, always probably tried to control conversation.
You say that you made your father tell your mother about his outside relationships with other women and his children by other women. How did you make your father tell your mother, if you don't mind my asking, what did you say to your father? And how old were you when you said it?
I was in my 20s. I was in London shooting a movie, and my father had booked a hotel room, and he and my brother have the same name, and the email confirmation accidentally went to my brother, and I found out about it. And at this point, I was offering financial support to my family, and something about using my money to cheat on my mom felt a little egregious. Like, it felt like a little bit too much. And a lot of feelings and a lot of emotion that I suppressed came rushing back. And it just felt like too much. It just felt like enough. And so I called him. I got very drunk and called him. And I was walking around on the streets in London. It, like, God, I remember it being so late, like after midnight. And I started the conversation with, "This will all go okay as long as you don't lie to me." And I'm glad I said that, taking lies off the table immediately, because it went okay. He listened and apologized, and yeah. It was a really strong conversation, really hard one to have. I was really scared.
Was he shocked that you knew?
He said at the end of that call, "I always knew you'd be the one." I think I say that in the special, but
yeah, you do.
That's true. Yeah. He said that. And I think that a lot had changed between us. Like, the power dynamic, it shifted. You know, I was the breadwinner, but I had less fear of like the consequence of asking questions, I guess. I argued more. I think it made sense. I think it made sense to him.
So, continuing with you telling your father that he had to tell your mother about his affairs, about his children outside of their marriage. And so you told him he needed to do that, and he did it. He told your mother. Did you worry that maybe your mother was better off not knowing? Maybe the best thing for her life was to continue living without that knowledge, without that really painful knowledge?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I thought it would be over.
That she'd leave
you say
him?
It and it's over. Well, I don't even know what I thought the exact reaction would be, but something explosive. Yeah, I thought it would be devastating.
Well, you asked your mother about finding out about this in your special home videos. So I thought I'd play an excerpt of that in which you're asking your mother about, you know, learning about these secret relationships and staying with your father in spite of it.
You ever think about leaving?
I did at first. Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now I'm not. No, I'm good.
No moments of resentment, no moments of anger?
No, I chose not, because I know resentment would build in. So that's why, like I said, it was a gradual thing, and I'm not going to sit here and say the hurt and anger didn't try to build, because I'm human. But maybe I suppressed some of it, but then I got enough talking and asked enough questions that, I don't know, like I said, I'm pretty much content. And it's on him to prove to me that I can trust him again, so it's not on me.
Has he been proving it?
For the most part.
Do you question him now?
Yeah. Really, I don't really have to question, because he's so on it now. He opens up and tell me, well, as far as I know, everything.
It's hard for me to let go and understand.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, just go like, oh, because you're my mother, I know you very well, and I know that you actually don't stay up at night thinking about it.
No.
You know. Yeah. What brings you that? How do you have the ability to do that?
One name, Jesus.
Getting back to the church again. So, do you think in retrospect that you did the right thing in getting out the truth?
Well, yeah, always, always. That was a lot to hear the playback. One, because I haven't been talking to my mother a lot, so just hearing her voice first thing in the morning is a lot for me right now.
You made a joke in an earlier comedy special about how a friend of yours came out, and you didn't know why, because he was doing very well, and he should have waited until he needed the applause and the support. So what were you thinking about when you came up with that for your comedy special, for an earlier one?
I don't know what I was thinking. Like I don't know if it's like me trying to separate myself from it by adding commentary to gay people the same way I would give commentary on women, or comment, kind of trying to be an equal opportunity, you know, I don't know the word, but, you know,
critic?
To choose my topics. Mm-hmm. Yeah, critic, I guess. Yeah. And I don't know exactly what the logic was, but definitely it was written as someone so far removed and out of touch with who he was. I was looking at myself from 30,000 feet in the air. I wasn't writing that joke with any true connection to my life. You know, it's me trying to hide with commentary, I think. You know what's funny? I actually remember saying a joke about gay people one time at an open mic, and a comic who was gay got angry with me, and he went up after, and I remember he did a set commenting on that, you know, and like just kind of trashing the joke that I said, and he came up to me after. It was just at an open mic. This was years ago. And he came up to me, in the lobby, and just said he didn't like it. And I remember actually apologizing to him, maybe a little bit to myself, but I just remember thinking I don't want to be that person. It was self-hate. I think that was like a little peek through of like, oh wait, is that what I'm doing? Like it was I don't remember the exact joke, but it was aggressive. I remember it being like some aggressive joke, brushing up again. And the guy had on a great leather jacket too. It was a great leather jacket, and he was attractive. Like it's something I couldn't have said then, you know. And I'm not like, I don't really remember his jokes, but I remember being like, oh, he's kind of hot. Like, and like, you know, yeah, I felt bad.
You know, you said that there was a period. There's been periods in your life where you thought you'd rather die than come out. What were the consequences that you feared?
Being disowned. Everything gay. Well, even like when we would use it as a term of like, oh, that's gay, or it was just a dismissal of a person or a thing. It's just, it was a wall. It was like, oh, well, I don't want any parts of anything that's gay, you know? And I just felt like I would just be banished from the lives of my friends. They'd be embarrassed to be seen around me. These are the thoughts that I'm having, you know. They'll be embarrassed. They'll be that everything's high school, and that they'll just mock me. I've also been straight long enough to hear how straight people talk about gay people sometimes.
What was the model of masculinity you grew up with?
I mean, the word hyper comes to mind. I think there were, in a world without fathers, I think there was an overcompensation. So people find fathers elsewhere. You'll find a father. You'll find like you need it for balance. And unfortunately, a lot of my friends didn't know their dad, and, you know, found it from other guys who didn't know their dad. And you know, there was always the potential of violence. The friends have gotten killed over, like, ego, over protecting that masculinity. It's all such a grand performance.
Race was an issue, too, when you were coming out, in the sense that, like, one of your boyfriends was white. And in one of your home videos, and home videos is another HBO special, an earlier one, you're talking, I think it's to your sister, to one of your sisters, and you say, how would you react if I brought home a white girlfriend? And she says, you know, that she wants you to embrace black love. And you kind of question, like, well, you know, what does that mean? But anyways, so when you had a white boyfriend and you were keeping secret that it was a boyfriend and that the boyfriend was white, like, can you talk about that the double secret, the, like, racial and sexual secret?
You know the racial part, less of a secret and more of something that I need to explore in my own life about, and I find men of all races very attractive, but like what root of self-hate or fear causes me to not date as many black men as white men, you know, like and that's something that I'm cautious to say. It's a mandate I want to change because that just sounds so false and corny and not organic and whatever. But I am exploring, like, what is that, right? And there was this movie called Beach Rats that I loved. And I was in the closet at the time, so I couldn't express how much I loved it. I love that movie. And it's about, I won't spoil too much of it. It's worth seeing, but it's a closeted young man who hooks up with guys from the internet, but he hooks up with older guys. And one of the older guys asks him, why are you into older men? And he says, because you don't know anyone that I know. And it's such a powerful line. And I feel like, you know, that fear is in me, or was in me. I'm trying to eradicate it, but that fear of, oh, is this my friend? Is this, like, you know, especially earlier on when I was, like, hooking up and it was more discreet and like, trying to keep a secret. I was afraid of being with a black guy because he may know my family or may know. It's illogical, but, like, it's just this fear of association, this fear of, yeah, it's just too close, and it became all too real. That's messed up. It's self-hate playing out.
How old were you when you realized you were gay?
I don't know because I've had experiences with other boys when I was a kid, and I've had, you know, little secret things here and there throughout my life. But when I was younger, when the internet and internet porn would come around, I would watch gay porn. And then immediately after, I would watch straight porn, almost as if to cleanse it, almost as if to get rid of what I'd just done, to cover up the sin, to kind of hide it, right? Like, and it's a silly psychological game that I play with myself. It's a game of one. No pun intended. But you see what I mean? Like, the example of that, like, what am I doing in that situation? I don't know. I'm hiding. I'm trying to make it better. I'm trying to fix it. I'm trying to make it right. You know, like the little psychological things like that, to make it go away. That I would try and do that to myself. And so when I was younger, I believed myself to be on a straight path. Eventually, I would have convinced myself to marry a woman in some world. I would have. Yeah, I definitely was suppressing it, running from it, hiding from it. So how long before I
realize that what I was gay. I don't know. It just kind of became undeniable. And I guess later in life, I was, you know, I'm someone, and I'll use air quotes, that probably leans a bit more masculine. So I could hide it. I could have never come out. And, you know, some people suspect, if you know my affinity for Dries Van Noten, but like, you know, for most of the world, I was straight presenting. So I was able to hide, you know, even as a kid. You know, I didn't really play sports, but, you know, my jeans were just baggy enough to be trade, you know, to be.
Well, you know, we talked about how deeply religious your mother is. And in her view of Christianity, like, homosexuality is a sin. Like, she is really having trouble accepting that. And that is part of the reason why you've had such trouble accepting it and being open about it over the years. But, you know, you say that you're still Christian, but that it's taken a lot, and that you've had to reconfigure God and what God is in order to accept yourself and kind of rebuild from there. What was church like when you were growing up?
Fun, actually. It was fun. I sang on the choir. I had a lot of fun. Even as a child, I would go to Bible study on Wednesday nights and just, you know, get in arguments about faith. And it was really fun. It's a great social event, you know, Sunday morning. You know, I had friends. There were a lot of kids at the church. I used to run the sound room for a little while. Very, very involved in the church, plays. And yeah, it was like my first performance space. My mom was an usher, and I've always been obsessed with microphones my whole life. And she used to, like, after church, she would hold me up to the mic when the church was clearing out, like when they were, like, shutting everything down. She would, like, hold me up to the mic so I could speak in it, because I just love the sound. Like, it's just such a miracle. and church was just, like, the first place that, like, gave me a microphone and an audience. And it's a great show. It's an excellent show.
Did you ever do comedy in church?
I mean, I probably did comedy everywhere. I mean, but yeah, definitely. I was pretty funny there. And it was always fun to make adults laugh. Like, I was one of those kids who really liked making adults laugh, because making other kids laugh was easy. You could do something big and, you know, slip on a banana peel. But, like, adults, you had to use intellect to make adults laugh. So I love making, like, go and, like, laugh and argue and have honest conversations about God. And yeah, it was so fun. I'm sorry, I don't even know if I'm answering your question. I'm just, like, reflecting on, like, it was a great space. It was a lot of laughs.
So, like, comedy was like your superpower. You know, you had to hide your actual identity, like a lot of superheroes have to do, but you had the superpower, which was comedy.
Yeah, it's like a competition that makes you feel good, you know, like when it's in a group setting like that, you know, like comedy's just like, because Black people are so funny. like that also has to be said, that, like, the average Black person is a top 10 comedian. like a church Blackford, like, it's just so many laughs. Like, the culture is funny. Like, the culture is, I think that's why Black people are so cool. Like, we're able to, like laugh at things and even laugh at ourselves in certain ways. Like, it's like, you know, like, everybody's kind of, like, telling jokes, and like it's a funny environment. So, you know, to be honest with you, to be a funny guy in those environments is an honor. It's probably, like, the biggest honor of my life, is like to be funny amongst kings and queens. Like, they are very funny.
So, you know, I just want to end by saying that I hope you and your mother kind of get back together again, because you seem like you're so close in so many ways. And I hope that she's able to eventually appreciate the openness that you have now and the acceptance of yourself and the reality of your truth, and meet you there.
Thank you for that. And I hope so, too. And I know it starts with myself, like, you know, and it's not me trying to take responsibility for anyone else's feelings. But I do know that the world can't love me, my mother included, or anyone else until I have a firm foundation and I know who I am and I'm willing to accept who I am. And, you know, that's a process that I feel like I started late, but, you know, the more honest I am, the freer I am. And I hope that time helps.
Gerard Carmichael, thank you so much for talking with us. It's just really been great to speak with you again and hear you be so open. And I think it's been great for your comedy. I love the new special. And it sounds like it's been really good for your life as well. So congratulations on all of that.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate talking to you. I appreciate your words. It's been fun.
My interview with Gerard Carmichael was recorded in April. In September, he won an Emmy for Outstanding Writing for a Variety Special. That HBO special, Rothaniel, is streaming on HBO Max. Our series featuring some of our favorite interviews of the year will continue tomorrow with Michael Imperioli.